Bandwidth for this podcast is provided by CacheFly at cachefly.com. This is the iPhone Ellie Podcast, episode 69 for January 13th, 2010. Do you know who I am? iPhone Ellie Podcast time, the show that discusses all things iPhone, iPod Touch, App Store, all that good stuff. Tonight with me is Mr. Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, as always, it's great to be here. And don't you love how I can sit here and flounder through my technological ineptness right before the show starts, and then you say, hey, Jeff, and all of a sudden I sound like I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, and Adam Christensen is here from the MacCast. Hey, Adam.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, how are you?
Good.
And I assume Jeff is good, too. I answered
you know,
for him.
I am. I am good. And thank you for being my proxy.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you were at CES, right? Adam, you were not?
I was not.
But Jeff was.
I
Jeff
stayed
got to
far,
see...
far away, which is good advice for most people.
Okay, Jeff.
And considering how big CES is, staying far, far away is actually quite an accomplishment.
It's true. And I'm not that far away, actually.
That's true. So,
geographically speaking.
Jeff, when have you been to CES before?
No, actually, this is my first time. CES typically falls during Macworld Expo, and since Macworld Expo has been moved to February this year, I was able to go to CES.
Now, the chat room wants to know if it was fun.
Oh, sure, it was fun. Oh, hey, Evan. Yeah, it was fun. It was really big, and
did you see
had
everything?
I not prepared ahead of time to know the companies I wanted to talk with, I would have just roamed aimlessly and lost through the entire Las Vegas Convention Center.
That's good to know. Unlike Macworld, where you can pretty well make your rounds.
Right. Yeah. See, the cool thing about Macworld Expo is that when you hit the expo floor, as long as you have a few days, you don't have to set up a schedule, excuse me, with specific companies that you have to see, although I do tend to set a lot of meetings. But you can hit the expo floor and just walk, and typically you're going to find something that is really cool. And at CES, you're probably not going to have that happen because there are so many booths that you'll just kind of wander through and you'll see lots of flashy lights and then you'll just kind of be lost.
Did you see the quadricopter that everyone was talking about?
Yes, I did.
And is it as cool as everyone made it out to be? I think I saw that thing on the internet maybe 50 or 60 times. Different places.
Yeah, I actually didn't tweet about that at all. I saw it and I thought, okay, that's kind of fun, and then stepped away because I realized someone was going to put an eye out with that thing, and I didn't want it to be my eye.
Yeah. So what did
yeah,
you?
It's just a little helicopter, and you have and there's an iPhone app, and you can control the helicopter with the iPhone app, and it, yeah.
Was that from Parrot? I think it was from Parrot, the guys who did the Stark speaker and a lot of other really expensive audio things.
Now yeah. They have a really expensive iPhone-controlled yeah. helicopter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what else did you see at CES that was that caught your eye?
You know...
Any iPhone stuff?
I was asked every day. As I would go around booths and then run into other people that are in our news world, you know, what's the cool thing you saw? And what I found is that it wasn't a show of brand new cool things being announced. It was a show where companies were showing off what they already had, or in many cases, talking about products. excuse me, talking about products that they hope to ship but haven't. So it was hard for me to get really excited about a lot of the things that I was seeing because I know how the game is played. You show off a bunch of cool stuff and say, we'll be shipping third quarter, and we may never see it.
Yeah, it has. In that regard, it has a little bit of that whole car show feel to it, right? You have the kind of new model stuff that's all out, and then everything, you know, a lot of the, oh, this is a concept, almost.
Right, right. But that said, I did see a few things over the course of the week where I went, okay, that's actually cool. So let's see, what did I see? Oh, okay, so Extreme Mac, they're coming out with a new iPhone battery charger case that's really thin, it's really lightweight, and it looks really nice. So that what I played with at the expo was a pre-shipping model, meaning one of the spec units they got back from the factory that's making them, and that should be out in a few weeks. So that one I consider a pretty solid vaporware thing. It's really going to be shipping, and it's going to be $80, and it was really nice.
So you said it's from Extreme Mac?
Extreme Mac.
Those are the guys who did the IV, right? That other power, that little jetpack thing? Or was that a different company?
I think that's a different company.
Who did that one? I can't remember. Is that, it's not Extreme Mac. Fast Mac?
Maybe Fast Mac. That one's Fast Mac.
Fast Mac. Yeah. So did you check out the Air Stash? Had you heard anything about that? The little portable wireless media thing for your iPhone?
You know, I never got to their booth.
Yeah, so it's essentially, a little, it looks like a really big flash drive, and you stick an SD card in the back of it, and it's got a Wi-Fi module in it, a little web server, and a battery, and it lets you bring around a whole bunch of extra storage for your iPhone or your computer or whatever wireless devices that you have.
Yeah, it sounds very cool. It was just one of those things where I simply ran out of time and didn't get to go see it.
Yeah.
So I'll have to catch up with them later.
Yeah. But, well, there is no shipping date. There are no shipping dates or prices on that yet, but it does look cool. So we're hoping to see that actually come to market and hopefully have an iPhone app that'll go with it, because right now it's just a web browser kind of access thing. But did you get to see Mophie's booth at all?
Yes, but only for a few minutes.
So Mophie has the Flow TV, right? And they had a credit card reader too, right?
Yes. And I actually couldn't get at the thing because the few minutes that I had to go to their booth, there was just a big group of people there. And I couldn't get up and to see the credit card reader, had another meeting and had to take off and wasn't able to get back. So I didn't get to see the credit card reader up close. I was really bummed about that.
But did they have anything for the Flow TV yet? Or was that just an announcement?
I think that was just an announcement. I didn't actually see anything.
I think it was Jim Dalrymple. Am I saying that right?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote about the Flow TV and Mophie partnership, where essentially they would be building a Flow TV unit inside of a Mophie juice pack. So you'd have the juice pack for the power, for extra power and viewing of TV from like ABC and Fox and MTV and NBC and that kind of stuff from your iPhone, right? And that's just over the air.
Right. So that'll be very cool. And, you know, actually, I don't know. And okay, so keep in mind when I say this, since I wasn't able to actually speak with anyone at the Mophie booth, I don't know for certain, but it felt like all these new things that they had weren't shipping products. So it was like many of the other booths where they're showing off things that will be at some point in the future.
Right, and that's kind of what CES tends to be, right?
Yeah, and I wasn't expecting that. I thought there'd be a lot more of the, hey, here, look what we're announcing, and it's available now. But, you know, at CES, it kind of makes sense that stuff wouldn't be available because it's not a public show, so people aren't out there on the expo floor buying things.
Right, exactly. It's not like Macworld. And I'm honestly, at this point, we have less than 30 days, right, until Macworld?
That sounds, yeah.
Was it?
Don't remind
29
me.
Days?
Yeah, how about that?
Does the expo floor opens on the 11th, right?
On the 11th, yeah. I'm excited about it. I'm just not prepared, and I've got
nobody's prepared. I don't think anybody's prepared. I think this is, you know, past CES now. I think I got my second email about, you know, talking with a vendor, and it seems like there are going to be quite a few app developers there. Just I'm guessing we're going to see maybe 25% iPhone app developers at this year's Macworld, maybe more.
You know, okay, so on the app developer thing, since I'm apparently just going to jump around without any care about what you're talking about. you know, when they talked about the whole pavilion thing at CES and it was going to be all this stuff set up for iPhone and iPod accessory makers and then Mac stuff and then an area for developers, that is so not what it was. It was everyone showing off their iPhone cases and other iPhone accessories. And RadTech was there. And, you know, and they make some accessories for, excuse me, for the MacBook and MacBook Pro. It was definitely not a show with developers there.
That's interesting on a couple fronts, and I want to ask you about that, Jeff, seriously, because a lot of those so there's two questions there. One, I guess what you're getting at is probably what Michael's saying is that we will see more iPhone developers likely at Macworld than you did at CES. But secondly, I was kind of curious on the whole iLounge, because it was sponsored by iLounge, right? It was like the iLounge
Pavilion or something,
right?
Like
it was,
right?
The iLounge Pavilion, right?
And it was all, okay, a bunch of just case makers that suck up to the iLounge, right?
Well, the question, because there's a lot of, like, RadTech, I love RadTech, and they don't just do iPhone accessories and stuff like that. And I haven't checked them. I probably should pull up the Macworld list so I know what I'm talking about. But it's my understanding, like, Belkin, Griffin, I think.
I think Griffin's going to be.
Right. Mac Assist Mac Alley was there.
Okay, so a bunch of these guys aren't, I think, going to be at Macworld, and we're looking at CES to be the kind of thing where they were going to show off that stuff. So the question is, do you think they made the wrong choice? I mean, what was the vibe there from a Mac perspective? Because at Macworld, those booths, you know, those are like rock star booths. Those are booths that they're getting a lot of press. They're getting a lot of, you know, people coming over and checking out their stuff. CES is a big show. I'm sure there was a lot of that, but more on the media, like press side, do you think? Because if I'm a tech journalist going to CES, I have a lot of crud I have to go look at.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, iPhone, iPod cases and accessories might not be, you know, a core focus, a booth that I'm going to get to, but I get the feeling at Macworld there's a lot of people that go there just for those kinds of accessories because they're writing about Mac and iPod and iPhone stuff. Whereas at CES, it's more of a technology in general show. They kind of try to make this focus in a one area, but I think it would be a hard sell, especially if you're a smaller publication, to say, oh, I'm going to send you to CES, knowing that you have to still go to probably Macworld, to, you know, in a month, splitting that budget. So I'm just kind of curious if it worked out or if it didn't work out. And it sounds like maybe your sense is it didn't.
Well, actually, it depends on the company. And I was talking to a lot of the companies that make products that are Apple product compatible. And the vibe I was getting was that this year is an experiment. And so there's a lot of companies that were there trying to figure out which was going to be the right show for them. And what it comes down to is which audience do they want for an expo? Are they looking for an audience where they can potentially find new distribution channels? Or are they looking for that audience where they can be talking to their end buyers or, you know, consumers? So if they're looking for distribution channels and that's all their focus is, then CES may be the right place to be. But if they want to actually talk to the people that are buying and using their products, then Macworld's a place to be. And I also think that if they want to have a higher likelihood of having a higher concentration of journalists to talk to, Macworld might be better And that's simply because CES is so large that it's impossible for anyone to talk to all the companies they want to. I mean, for me, I had to set one day for the North Hall, one day for the Central Hall, and one day for the South Hall. And if something happened and I couldn't hit one of the companies in one of those halls on the day that I had scheduled for them, that was it. I wasn't going to be able to get back because it was so big that if I missed something, there just was no way to make it up later. So, yeah. You know, for those companies that had a clear focus on what it is that they were looking for out of a trade show, and that was the right kind of trade show, great. Then that was probably just fine for them. And for the companies that were just maybe falling in line with the hype that this is going to be the show that replaces Macworld, well, they probably walked away very disappointed because it is not a replacement. It's a completely different type of show for a completely different audience.
Yeah, it absolutely sounds that way. And I'm browsing through the exhibitor list on MacworldExpo.com right now, and I'm seeing a lot of the companies that we just talked about, most of them aren't going to be there. Like you said, Adam, Belkin, right. Griffin, those guys aren't going to be there. Mophie isn't going to be there.
Is Radtech?
Radtech
may be there.
Okay. They haven't confirmed yet. They're not on the list right now.
Yeah, when I was talking to them, they were figuring out what their plan was. So there's a possibility they could be there.
You think a lot of there were some manufacturers and exhibitors at CES that are maybe rethinking jumping into Macworld at the last minute?
Maybe. But keep in mind, a lot of these companies have pretty tight budgets.
Right, that's true.
You know, for shows. And so they had to pick one show, and they can't do both.
Mm-hmm. Even maybe with a Griffin or a Belkin, exhibiting at CES probably costs a lot more money than it does at Macworld.
I don't know. I mean, it may not, but I don't know what booth space costs it for either show, but it's not going to be cheap either way. And I think for some of the companies, and keep in mind, I'm just speculating because no company has flat out told me this, but it wouldn't surprise me if some of the companies went to CES because they're just unhappy for whatever reason with the way things were going with Macworld Expo.
Well, I hope that those companies that did decide to go to CES this year got in, you know, more publicity, or at least the same amount that they would otherwise get at Macworld. But I hope so. By looking through this list, I'm seeing quite a few iPhone developers in this list, way more than I thought I would see. I'm also seeing guys like TomTom and Navigon in here. I know that AppCubby, the guys who do GasCubby, one of my favorite iPhone apps, they're going to be there, and I'm actually going to be at the AppCubby booth on and off, probably more so on Saturday, helping out because they're actually sponsoring my trip out in part, and so that's cool.
Well, that's very cool.
Yep, the Omni Group is going to be there, as always. If you want to go check this out, go to macworldexpo.com/expo and click on exhibitor list, and you can see everybody who's going to be there. But I am seeing a lot of developers here.
Yeah, there's a lot of companies, a lot of people that are afraid that there won't be a lot of companies to see at Macworld Expo. And I don't think they need to worry about that. There's going to be a wide range of companies that are there. And I have a feeling that some of the companies that aren't there with a booth may still be there, just not in an official capacity.
Yeah, that does happen.
Yeah. I mean, that happens at every expo. So if you know where to look and who to ask, you may be able to find the people at some of the other companies that you really want to talk to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not seeing even Delicious Monster on here this year.
That's interesting.
That is interesting. I'm guessing that Will be at the expo. Does he live in San Francisco now, or is he still up in Seattle?
No, he's in the Bay Area now.
Okay.
So, and I think his whole Delicious team is in the Bay Area now, too. I'm not completely sure, but I think they've all moved down, too.
Okay, maybe I should give him an email, and I'm sure we'll talk to a lot of other developers as soon as the emails start rolling in for meetings and all that. at Macworld. But we have some iPhone news. We got really carried away with the CES stuff.
See, yeah. There's iPhone news?
There is. There's a little bit of iPhone news. So the first
thing is, we could probably talk all night just about CES, but you're right, there's more stuff.
Yeah, so the first thing on our list is AT&T has completed their tower upgrades to the 7.2 megabit per second point. And right now, most users aren't going to notice a difference because they have to upgrade their backends on the towers, which they plan to have completed throughout 2010 and 2011.
Boo.
Boo.
Why are they even telling us? It's like a big old tease. Like, hey, we have 7.2 megabit per second towers.
You know, I'm guessing that they...
Exactly. You can't use them.
I'm guessing it's because of all the negative press they were getting last week week before that about how they weren't spending any money on upgrading their networks.
You know, I think that's it, coupled with they want to be able to say, look, can Verizon say the same thing?
Right. So I would like to test my network here, but I don't think that would do anything for me. Do you do any speed tests in your area, Adam?
You know, I really don't, but this is the weird thing. Okay, this is a thing that keeps coming up every time we talk about coverage and bandwidth and things like that. From a day-to-day basis, there is very rare occasion where I pick up my iPhone and try and do something with it and go, oh, it's not working.
Right.
It just doesn't happen. So I guess I just never notice. There's nothing that it's ever doing that I would want to complain about. It's like I launch the app runs, it downloads its data, it sends emails, it surfs the web, so I don't know. I don't notice that it's slow or fast or, you know, on an average basis. Occasionally there's some weird anomaly, but they're so rare that I just don't find myself being frustrated with my phone. So I never run a speed test because it never even crosses my mind that I need to.
Right.
I'm in the same boat. My iPhone just works, and it works reliably. I rarely drop calls. And I started hearing, I think it was yesterday, that people were saying that AT&T was a total fail during CES, that everyone with an iPhone was completely screwed. No one can get online. No one could talk. And I never had a moment's trouble.
I didn't hear anything about that either. And I did notice that you were twittering throughout.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was roaming the expo floor, that mass, but it takes up the whole fracking convention center. And I was able to be in the center of the South Hall lower level. So I was basically in a bomb shelter. And I still was able to tweet.
I think that's even better than what we had during Podcast Expo in, 2008? Was that the year I was there?
Substantially better. Yeah. And for reference, we were in the North Hall for the Podcast Expo.
Okay.
And most of the time, I had to step out of the hall back out into that sort of atrium area where it's closer to where the Starbucks is.
Sure.
And I could get a signal from there. But this time, it was no big deal. It didn't matter where I was in the convention center. I had a good signal.
Cool. Well, I think they are rolling out a lot of interesting technologies in Las Vegas. Obviously just, improving AT&T's network. But I've also heard that they're using that area to test the new 4G stuff for Sprint, the Clear thing, the WiMAX. Mm-hmm. So that's good. Okay, so moving back into the iPhone stuff, it seems that there have been that the App Store approval process has been improved quite a bit, as in their turnaround has gone from whatever days to 24 to 48 hours is what we have been seeing lately. Ever since they brought because over the holiday period they took the store down. The iTunes Connect, the store was up. They took down iTunes Connect, the spot where developers actually upload and input information for their applications, and it came back up. Was that later in December, something like that? And now everyone's saying that the approval process is drastically improved. And the first time we noticed that was when Facebook released their updated application with push notifications and context sync. So I went to try and use that, the context sync feature, and it messed up all of my contacts, and I had a backup, and I fixed it. But there was obviously a problem. But later that night, or you know, early in the morning, there was another update to Facebook. And I thought, that's weird. You know, Facebook must be getting special attention. Well, it turns out we've seen a lot of comments from other people on the site talking about how their applications have been approved in a matter of a couple days. And we're also seeing that being reported on other sites like Apple Insider as well.
You know, at CES, I had the CES application on my iPhone so that I could just keep a track of everything I was doing at the show, kind of a cool little app. And one of the push notification features tells you when there's an application update. And during the week that I was there, I think I got three notifications of app updates for the CES app while I was at the show. Yeah, and I didn't think anything of it at the time because I was so busy.
Yeah.
And I hadn't done the Facebook app update because I was so busy. But when I got back home, I started checking out all that other stuff and realized, yeah, that some of these updates are coming out really fast.
That is interesting. You got to wonder if they either, you know, hired another 500 people or something, or if they just kind of improve the approval like some kind of automated thing, because they did it was CNBC, right, that did the Planet of the Apps special over the last week. Did you guys catch that?
No, that happened while I was in Vegas, I believe.
Okay, yeah, so I checked it out.
I don't get CNBC.
Okay, and it was just basically a lot of spotlighting of developers and talking about how great applications are and all of that. And I wonder if maybe that had anything to do with Apple improving their approval process because of, you know, major press regarding actual development of applications and how fast they come out of the App Store. Because I think on the special, they mentioned that, you know, some developers, you know, it had taken a long time to get their applications approved. I think they mentioned that on the special. So while that might not be directly the reason for it, I wonder if it has a little bit to do with it now that there's so much more focus on the App Store. But it is good regardless of the reason that we're seeing kind of regular updates now. And I wonder if the guys at Rogue Amoeba might decide to go back to iPhone development. I think they would have to wait for a while to see how quickly and if it's sustained, if this quick approval process is sustained for the applications.
You know, I think there'll need to be some other changes before Rogue Amoeba decides to come back. And one of those changes is clearer guidelines for and clearer parameters for what is and isn't allowed in applications. Because that was one of the problems they had too. I mean, slow approval process, and then they thought that some of the, wasn't it APIs that they were calling from were okay, and then Apple says no.
It was the artwork thing, actually.
Oh, right.
Because they were pulling artwork from the Mac, and it was being displayed on the iPhone, and it looked like a
copy. That's right,
Like a trademark issue.
And based on the licensing they had, they thought, okay, we're fine. And then turns out, well, maybe not. And then it was kind of a big mess trying to sort all that out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's move on to the tablet stuff, shall we? There have been recent patents hinting at the next-gen tablet touchscreen, or possibly for the iPhone. It's an interesting patent that shows the touch sensor being integrated into an LCD screen, as opposed to the way it's done now, where that digitizer is kind of overlaid on top of the screen. So it's kind of a two-layer thing. And I guess the idea is that you could get thinner devices this way.
You know, if it works, that would be very cool. Until the first time you sit on your tablet or iPhone and snap it in half.
Right. Now, is it your experience, Adam or Jeff, that these patents that come out, that surface, do we see a lot of what comes out of these patents actually, you know, happen in real products?
I think no. I think a lot of what we see in the patents, we don't see.
That's what I've gotten from a lot of these. I've seen a lot of patents over the time that I've covered this, and hardly any of them. Either they're patents for things that we've already seen, or they're patents for things we will never see.
Right. And keep in mind, when a company patents technology like that, they may not be planning on using it, but they want to keep other people from using it.
Right. Yeah, that's a very common technique. And actually, I kind of consciously stopped really covering a lot of the patent stories just because of that, because it generally is technology that you're not going to see. Or a lot of times I think, too, it's technology that is, again, they're wanting to lock it up because they see it as a potential technology for a product, but it's probably years out in terms of development.
Right.
You know, so it might show up, you know, 3 years from now. But usually when they're uncovering these patents, sometimes they think, because it does take a couple years for the patent to even get approved. So a lot of the times, too, you have to dig in the story and see where is it? Is it an approved patent? Were they granted the patent? Because then it might be closer to being actually showing up in an actual product versus, oh, no, this is just a patent filing and they're going through the review process. So I kind of weigh that in when I'm kind of looking at these things, too, is like, at what point in the patent process is it?
Right. Now, we've also heard from Silicon Alley Insider, someone with industry inside news or information, that it's that it's pretty. The UI is pretty. It has a good bit of new sexy to it, and that it's just a big iPhone. Now, Jeff Gamet, you might have some information about this, because the Mac Observer posted an image of something that looked like a giant, giant iPhone screen,
iPhone surface.
Yeah, so tell us about that.
Okay, so the photo that we received came from a source that has been reliable and in the past, so they have a track record. So when I first saw the thing, I thought, okay, it looks like someone blew up a picture of the iPhone glass.
Right.
But because of the source, I have to put some credence into that. So I'm actually torn on that. But if it's legit, and it may very well be, hopefully we'll know soon. Yeah, it looks like the tablet type computer would have the same form factor as an iPhone or an iPod Touch. And the interesting thing, though, is that if you look in the upper left-hand corner of that glass, there's an extra hole.
Yeah, I did see that.
And I've had debates with Brian Chaffin about this, and he was thinking, like many other people, oh, well, that's where a camera would go for video chatting. And my thought was, why would you put a hole there when a camera can see through glass just like the eyesight on your MacBook Pro? You don't need the hole. So I'm thinking, if this is legit, that's actually a microphone hole.
Oh, yeah. Well, the weird thing about that picture is, and what makes me feel like it's still kind of fake, is the earpiece kind of hole. It looks like there's a spot for where the earpiece on an iPhone would be.
Hold on. Let me just open up this photo right now and take a quick look.
Because it definitely...
By coincidence, it's on my desktop.
It looks like someone, like you said, it looks like someone blew up an iPhone image. Something from, you know, one of the iPhone components.
Right. Holy crap, the image is loading slow. See, isn't that how it goes? We're doing a live show. No,
there's also a home screen button, too. From what I can tell, Adam, how do you feel about... Have you seen this picture?
No.
Oh, well, it's in the links that I gave you.
I'm looking for it. That's
oh, wait, we have links for
looking
tonight?
Like every link on here. Which one is it?
Maybe I didn't send it to you. But essentially, it has a hole for something, a hole for what looks like the iPhone earpiece, and a hole for what looks like an iPhone home button.
Right. Okay, so if you assume that you need to have a speaker in the thing, then and you want to have the speaker so that it's not just like in the iPod Touch where it kind of comes through the case, then why not just stick with the form factor that you already have for the iPhone, where you put a slit there for the speaker to come through?
So you think that's for a speaker?
I would assume that's for a speaker, and that the little circle hole that's in the upper corner is for a microphone, and then it has a home button just like the iPhone and the iPod Touch. Now, a problem, though, with the placement of that hole in the upper corner, unless Apple is totally abandoning ambidextrous use of their products, that's a bad place for that hole. Because if you hold it so that it's horizontal and you have the home button on the left, then you have that little hole in the upper right. So if it's a microphone, great. Okay, it's exposed. All right, so now if you rotate the device 180 degrees so that the home button is on the other side, so if you're going to use it left-handed or right-handed, you can flip it either way, that hole ends up under your hand. So that doesn't make sense to me.
I'm going to call fake on this, not because I don't trust you at the Mac Observer or maybe even your source. I think it's fake. Now, John Martellaro, you sent me this link last week during the show, I think, and I didn't have a chance to read it, but John Martellaro also writes for the Mac Observer, and he used to work for Apple, and he wrote an interesting piece on how Apple does controlled leaks of product information. Now, I think in some cases, do they leak false information? I didn't get that from his piece.
Well, of course. I mean, if we look at the whole, was it Asteroid?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's an example where it's pretty much believed. I mean, no one has proof, I think definitive proof, but it's pretty much believed that the Asteroid was a controlled leak to ferret out.
What was the Asteroid?
You remember the whole thing that led to the Apple suing a couple different...
Yeah, it was Apple Insider, right? Was it Apple Insider?
Yeah, and it was like O'Grady's Power Page and I think one other.
Yep. Think Secret?
Yeah, might have been Think Secret.
Okay.
And the gist of that story is that there was this leak from inside Apple about this new product that was coming out, and it was codenamed Asteroid. And it was like this hardware add-on that worked with GarageBand, and it was going to be really cool for mixing in audio.
It was a FireWire interface for GarageBand.
Right. And then the thing never materializes, and all of a sudden Apple is doing John Doe cases and trying to ferret out who's behind the leaks.
Right. So what John focused on in his piece is that they tend to have senior staff at Apple give little nuggets of information to trusted news outlets like the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
And he actually referenced in one of the Wall Street Journal's pieces online that simply said the Apple tablet ship date is going to be in March, that it will be unveiled this month, but it's going to be shipping in March.
Right. And it totally makes sense that Apple would do something like that, especially with all of the hype around what's going on with CES and are there new tablet devices coming out. And then we have the Nexus One from Google, and Apple needs to do their part to keep the focus on what they have coming out, keep that hype up so people are excited and ready to go out and buy whatever the next great thing is that they sent out to us.
Mm-hmm.
So that totally makes sense. Now, keep in mind what John wrote, which is absolutely fantastic, because he added clarity to a practice that a lot of people don't really understand. This is an industry practice. This isn't just Apple. This is something that all kinds of companies do, and governments do as well. It just so happens John was the person that really understood how this works and was able to put everything together and explain it in a way that really made sense to people.
Because he was a higher level up at Apple in the marketing department.
Well, okay, so he worked in the division in Apple that dealt with science-related companies. And so the whole thing about him being like a top-level
marketing
person,
manager? Yeah.
That's not right.
Okay.
Yeah, that someone else said that. Like I think they misinterpreted what his position was.
He says in his piece that he was a senior marketing manager at Apple.
Okay, so yeah, senior marketing manager in whichever division he was in.
Gotcha.
So it was at that division level. It's not like he was senior marketing for the entire company.
Right.
But even still, it works the same wherever you are. And it's one of those things that companies do, and I'm sure Apple does it on a regular basis. I mean, if you look way back in Apple's history, they were controlling leaks early on. And there's a quote from Steve Jobs from somewhere years and years ago where he said, "Isn't it ironic that this ship leaks from the top instead of the bottom?"
Yeah, yeah. So we're also hearing in the tablet space about these rumors that Apple is probably buying up a whole bunch of 10-inch OLED screens as well as LCDs. We heard this from an anonymous designer who tried to order some screens from who knows where. This is from TG.
Apparently from anywhere.
From anywhere. Okay. And this is from TG Daily that we're getting this information from. But essentially they're saying that in the kind of sense that Apple buys up all of the flash memory stock for iPods and iPhones and that kind of thing, it seems like Apple is now buying up OLED screens, 10-inch OLED screens, as well as LCDs. Now, it was said a couple of years ago that Apple was planning on doing this tablet. You know, it was still rumored, but that they were waiting on OLED screens to come down in price. And now, I think it, you know, are those screens at the price point where Apple could put it in a consumer device, a 10-inch screen?
I don't think so.
I would doubt it. From everything I've heard, is OLED screens are very expensive, and at that size, I mean, that's a pretty big size. I don't know if I've... Have you seen a product with a 10-inch OLED screen?
The only consumer product that I know of with an OLED screen is the Zune, the new Zune. And that's a much smaller screen.
Now, I checked out an OLED screen. It was a portable Blu-ray player from Sony. And I checked it out. It was actually about a year ago. And it was really cool. It was really slick. And it was crazy expensive. And it wasn't even a 10-inch screen.
Yeah, Evan in the chat room is saying that an 11-inch OLED TV costs $2,500. He's seeing somewhere online, I assume.
Okay. As I recall, that's in the price range that I was seeing this Blu-ray player last year.
Now, this source is also saying that all of the 10-inch LCDs are also being bought up, but it's interesting that Apple, that kind of takes away from the rumor.
I would be shocked if Apple comes out with an OLED screen on the tablet, simply because I think it would push the price well over $1,000. And I just don't think that's going to be, it just won't succeed at that price point. I think it's already going to be too expensive. I think it's going to come in closer to $800, $900, and it really needs to be around $600 before you have a lot of people buying it. So I think it's going to be LED. And, you know, I think the first place we'll see an OLED screen is maybe on the next iPhone.
Mm-hmm. That is
from Apple.
much more likely, considering we're seeing stuff like the Zune HD having OLED screens.
And I say maybe with, you know, a big question mark.
Right.
I'd be really surprised to see that happen on the next iPhone. But my feeling is OLED on the Zune HD is a marketing gimmick and nothing else.
Yeah. So we're hearing a lot more details about the iPhone as well as the tablet device now. I think we talked about last week how the feeling is if there is an event in January that we'll probably hear something about the iPhone as well. And the details are actually kind of coming together quite nicely for an iPhone announcement more so than a tablet, I think, because we're seeing rumors about, again, we're seeing that the launch will be in May, not June. That's one report that we've seen. We're also seeing that the next one might have a dual-core ARM processor.
That'd be kind of interesting.
And we're also seeing that right now the iPhone and the iPod Touch both have Power VR graphics chips in them. And we're hearing that the SGX545 is the rumored graphics chip for the next iPhone. And we're also seeing that Apple may be ordering LED flash components for their camera, which I'm looking forward to because, you know, I think most of the smartphones, the big name smartphones, the Droid, right, the Nexus One, those both have LED flash on their cameras, right? Does the Palm?
I believe so.
I wonder if the Palm Pre still has a flash there too. But that's one of those things.
Yes, the Palm Pre has LED flash.
Okay, yeah. And so that's one of those things that the iPhone's kind of been criticized for its camera. You know, it was upgraded to the 3 megapixels, but it still doesn't have flash.
I was just going to say, I have a question about that. And I asked this on my show. I think I have an email waiting in my inbox with someone giving their impressions on this. But to either of you, have either of you used one of these new cameras with the LED flash? And I'm just curious how much a difference it makes. The one thing that I read that I was more excited about with respect to an LED flash on the iPhone is that apparently with LED flashes, you can also use them as a constant on source. So as a light for video, which I think might be more useful. But I'm just curious, is LED flash as good as a standard flash? Because it seems like they're just a lot smaller, right? So will it really throw that much light to make that big of a difference in a camera phone?
Okay. Now, keep in mind, the only time I've seriously played with an LED flash was when I was playing with the Palm Pre. And what I found is that if you're doing something up close and it was dark, the LED flash would give you enough light. It'd be a very stark, unnatural light, but it would give you enough light to illuminate whatever it was so you could get a photo. And once you've got any type of distance, the LED doesn't throw far enough and it didn't make that much of a difference. But as soon as you said for video, I kind of like that idea. Being able to do the constant on so that when you have a lower light, close-up video thing that you're doing, I can see where that would be really handy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so to me, the quality of that flash is going to make a huge... See, in a non-Apple world, you're like, okay, LED flash, throw it in there. Great. It's an add-on. In an Apple world, to me... Steve Jobs looks at it and goes, that's another hole in my beautiful case.
Right.
And you've got to make a darn good case as to why you need to have that hole in there.
So I don't think you can make a good enough case for that.
Well, I'm looking at the piece talking about where that rumor comes from. And the firm that's rumored to be designing Apple's 5 megapixel camera for the next iPhone, also has an LED division, Luxion LED components, and there's a comparison between a standard LED flash and this super duper Luxion flash. And I don't know if you guys are seeing this, but you know, one looks terrible and one looks, you know, quite good for a photo taken in what looks like a really dark room.
Yeah. I think Apple puts enough clout behind aesthetics as they do functionality. So it seems more likely that they would be going back to the sensor manufacturer and say, we need a better low light performing sensor because we're not going to put a mediocre flash in there and ruin the design aesthetic of the device.
Right.
That's just my gut impression.
I would agree with you on that for sure.
If it's a mediocre flash, it won't be there.
I'm looking forward to it. I think we're going to see a good flash. Do you guys have any other input, any maybe just guesses, outright guesses on as to what we're going to see in the next iPhone? No?
Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, I was going to say I would love to answer the question, but I have no idea what you said because you totally broke out on my end.
Okay, I was just asking if either of you wanted to speculate on what the next iPhone's going to have or be or do.
Well, Adam, hop in because you were already talking.
I was going to go. Yeah, well, I just wanted to comment. You mentioned the processor being an ARM processor likely designed by, now the company's escaping, the company that Apple acquired.
PA Semi,
yeah, that wouldn't shock me. On the dual core side, though, I did read that, likely one of the cores would be shut down just for power reasons, and I think that's probably likely as well. I don't know that you necessarily need a dual core unless they're going to get somehow have figured out to allow multitasking, which I think was another rumor that I had read, that the next gen phone would allow background processes. That's one of those rumors that's floating around out there. I still don't put much clout in that one, only from the standpoint of my own personal experience that there's a rare instance when I really wish that I could be running some other app in the background. So unless they've worked through the battery issues and are over the concerns of, one app kind of conflicting or crashing another one, if they can somehow in the software do some really good sandboxing of that, that might be a new feature. But I put that at maybe 50-50 chance. I know a lot
I'm
of people would really love
that
to see it.
50-50 chance.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the one thing that's pushing me is that so many of the new phones are making that their marketing jab at Apple, that if there is any way they can do it, they might just do it just to keep competitive. That's the only hope I think multitasking on the iPhone has, is that somebody at Apple makes a strong enough case that, look, we have to compete with these other devices that are coming out there. But I guess that gets to the other thing that I've been thinking about with the iPhone lately, is that I think a lot of people forget that Apple's goal by 2010 was, 1% of global cell phone market share?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Which I believe Apple is completely over, right? I mean,
I assume
they're way
so,
over 1% of cell phone market share with the iPhone. And they make a lot of money off the iPhone. And I think what people aren't realizing, because there's been a lot of news this week with the Google Nexus One that, this is going to be the Android phone and this is going to be the year of them taking on the iPhone. I have no doubt that Android will probably be the dominant cell phone operating system very soon and probably go well beyond what the iPhone does. But I think people are forgetting that Apple doesn't probably care. They're going to have the best device on the market, and they're going to have the device for the people who want, the Apple experience.
Yeah.
And there's a lot in that. And, they're happy with 1%, 2%, 5% share and making a lot of money. I think people don't realize that it's not just all about having the most numbers or selling the most phones for Apple.
Yeah. So Superman in the chat room mentioned multitasking and a new battery, as well as voice control for the entire phone. That's one of those things that the multitasking is, that's one of the things I'm thinking the next iPhone should have.
Well, keep in mind, the iPhone already has multitasking. It's just for Apple's applications and not for third-party applications.
Right.
Right, yeah.
So, like Adam was saying about sandboxing and all that, until Apple figures out a way where they feel comfortable letting third-party apps do multitasking without screwing up processor usage and killing battery life, I don't see that happening.
Now, yeah, what if we had something like the Palm Prix has? Because Superman also mentions Pro Switcher, which is the Palm Prix-like multitasking hack for jailbreak phones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what if we had something that was very visible, very visual and obvious, that you had multiple applications going?
You know, if it impacted performance and battery life to a level that Apple wasn't happy with, I don't see it happening at all.
Okay. Well, that's my prediction.
And
I think we're going to see
Superman saying that his is running fine, which is great. So, you know, that gives a little more hope to the idea that maybe we can get third-party multitasking in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and Michael, to answer your question, you know, from my perspective, I think the iPhone is as great as it is. So I think a lot of the rumors that we're seeing, the next gen phone is just going to be, I think, a lot more of the same. And, you know, but faster, better camera, better graphics. You know, I think it's going to be an iPhone with just everything better, faster. I don't think it's going to be much more than that. Maybe there's some hope for some really new, innovative stuff in the operating system.
I think that's where we'll see a lot.
Yeah. I think that's where you're going to see the most. And I don't know what those are yet. I can't even fathom to think. Trying to think of where the software deficiencies in my iPhone are now. If anything, probably, you know, my biggest hassle is with, because there's so many applications, just application management. I'd really like to see them on the phone deal with somehow.
Yeah, like folders or some other really cool Apple-y way of doing things like that.
Yeah. It would be neat to see if they could do some more computer-like things with it now.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned folders and things like that. If there was some sort of more access to files, or, you know, extending basically a lot of the things that I do on my desktop, or making that even more of an extension of my desktop computer life. You know, it already is kind of a pretty good link to that, but I think they can do more in those areas. So I'd like to see that kind of stuff happening. But I think that's going to be an OS thing, and I think we're all going to benefit from it.
Now, Mac Assist is asking in the chat room if we might see some iTablet technology in the next iPhone. And my speculation is yes, from a software standpoint, although it wouldn't surprise me if Apple has some magic technology that they want to include in a tablet device to help differentiate it more from the smaller handheld devices like the iPhone and iPod Touch.
Yeah, that's my feeling too, is that we're going to see some maybe operating system software crossover from the iTablet, maybe innovations when they were coming up with stuff for the tablet making their way down into the iPhone, because we're all assuming that they're related products.
Well, right. Yeah, and one of the rumors was that already happened, right? From last week?
Right, yeah, because I guess the tablet's been in production for several years, and they've just been kind of waiting on everything to fall into place, and right? Is that what you're talking about? Having
that
kind of stuff go into the iPhone?
Yep.
Yeah,
Apple has been working on tablet-like devices for a really long time. That's no secret.
Mm-hmm.
And every one of them, as far as we know, has been killed. So it wouldn't surprise me if, yes, we are seeing technology that evolved from their tablet project in the iPhone and iPod Touch already. We'll see more of that when they come out with whatever tablet device they release. And eventually we'll see blending of those technologies, and we'll see that same technology start showing up in Apple laptops as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I would like to move to I put on your show notes that it's going to be to be announced. It's a secret, because I have a very interesting confession for you guys. I, over the weekend, restored my iPhone, and after restoring, I decided that I would jailbreak. And part of the process for my restoring was to jailbreak before I actually restored, so I could pull off some very specific bits of data, such as my SMS messages and couple other things that I did want to save because I wanted to restore, but not actually restore the backups that iTunes made, because I feel like there's a lot of extra stuff in there that I didn't want. So I pulled off a couple things, you know, using SSH and backed those up and then restored. And then I have to jailbreak again to put that information back in there. But instead of making a backup and then, you know, restoring to a non-jailbroken state and putting all that back on there, I decided to remain jailbroken. And so I'm running a jailbroken phone for the first time in quite a long time, because iPhone Alley used to focus quite a bit on the jailbreak stuff. So I wanted to share my experience with having a jailbroken phone, because I don't think either of you do the jailbreak.
Right.
Nope. Yeah.
One question before you dive into that.
Sure.
Because I'm just curious. So to pull your SMS data off, you used like an SSH?
Yeah, I did a secure FTP through SSH I think I used like Transmit or something. And I've monkeyed around with that stuff before, so I know. It's a very similar hierarchy to OS X. It is OS X, so
right.
I've just, you know, it's in a folder called SMS, and there's an SQL database or something like that.
Just more to my point, how come you do it that way versus you just using a tool like PhoneView or something like that?
When I was doing it, I was under the impression that PhoneView was broken. So later, after I had done the entire thing, one of my pals on the on iChat, who talks to me from iPhone Alley, let me know that, you know, PhoneView actually does that now. It has been updated. Or was it? It wasn't PhoneView. It was Backup Extractor. PhoneView won't pull that the actual raw database out and let you capture it as a file that you can put back on your phone later. But there's
okay.
There's
the answer.
Yeah, there's the iPhone Backup Extractor, which actually dives into your backups and lets you pull the stuff out of there. But I wasn't sure, you know, whether or not I could restore that information back in the same way that the iPhone understands how to read it. So just to be safe, I pulled everything in the way that I knew for sure I could put back easily.
Okay.
So I did that. And so I restored a full restore, did a jailbreak using BlackRain, which for those who have not done the jailbreak in a while or ever, it's incredibly easy now. With BlackRain from George Hotz, it's a matter of plugging in your iPhone. And when you open up BlackRain, there's one big button and it says make it rain, and you click it, and then your iPhone's jailbroken. And that's all. And then there's an app on your phone called BlackRain, and you can click it and unlock your phone if you want, or install something like Cydia or another software distribution thing. I think it's called The Rock, possibly. And so I installed Cydia. And from there, I installed SSH so I can put all my stuff back in there. And
you left the password defaulted, right?
Well, I eventually changed it.
We all need to get in your phone.
Yeah, no, I did change my password, actually, using the passwd command with terminal. And the next thing I installed was SB settings, which is, I think, a Big Boss creation. And what that lets me do, it's very cool. You swipe your status bar at the top, and then it brings down a nice little menu that allows you to, and this is customizable, to toggle stuff like Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, 3G, location information. You can toggle that stuff on and off right from this little menu that you can access from wherever. You can also turn on off SSH. You can access your phone's brightness from there. You can check out what processes are running, what applications. You can quit those. Right now I see all of Apple's super cool background apps such as Mail, Phone, Safari, and iPod all running. And you can also get a little special dock, an additional five application dock that goes along with this SB settings thing. And you can do stuff like restarting the Springboard, restarting your phone. But the really cool thing, the reason I actually got SB settings is because you can hide application icons using that too. So, for example, I have replaced the Notes application on my phone with Simple Note, and I had done that previously, but I still had the Notes app icon on my phone, so I just kind of pushed it off to the last page. So now I can hide my Notes app and I can also hide stuff like Cydia, so the genius can't tell that I have a jailbroken phone. But if I want to ever...
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah, if I ever want to get to it, though, all those applications can be found using Spotlight. So if it's something like Tweet Push, which is an application that just simply sends me push notifications and nothing more, I can hide that application. But if I ever want to get to it and change settings, I just, you know, type in Tweet Push into Spotlight, and there it is. It's just kind of a hidden icon. It's not gone. It's just hidden. So that's really
cool. It's very clever.
And I couldn't get enough. So the next thing I did was enable tethering on my phone. And I love tethering. I'm so happy I have it now. With the, I think it was 3.1 or the 3.12 update, one of the more recent updates to the iPhone, that disabled tethering using that profile hack where you just kind of go to someone's website and download a thing that says to your iPhone, these are the new settings for AT&T. Then because they changed it, so those settings had to be signed by Apple. They had to be official instructions. So then I went to hackthatphone.com, and they're our friends. They're kind of linked back and forth. They use our forums, and you know, we give them some link juice. And he's got a great tutorial on how to enable tethering on your 3.1.2 device, and it's a matter of patching your comm center file. And once you do that, you can use that standard old profile hack. And then I have tethering through the normal means of, just plugging it in or using Bluetooth. So that's awesome. And I couldn't get enough at that point, so I got Backgrounder too. And Backgrounder, for those who don't know, allows you to open up any application and say, you know what, I just want to keep this app running in the background all the time. And you set up a shortcut for that, either the using the home button, you hold it, or you use the sleep-wake button and you hold it. It'll pop a little notification up. It'll say backgrounding enabled, and then ta-da. That app is permanently running, and you can access that. Well, it's not permanent. It's just running in the background. But you can access it from your Springboard and, you know, open it back up. It's just running in the background. So that's really cool. And the next thing that I grabbed was Pro Switcher. And that's the really cool Palm Pre thing that everybody's been talking about recently. And so essentially, just if you've seen a Palm Pre, it lets you see all open applications as cards that you kind of swipe back and forth, kind of in the same manner as you do with Safari when you show multiple tabs in Safari on your iPhone, and you just swipe back and forth. And if you want to quit an app, you swipe it up and it's quit. And if you want to go to that application, you just tap it and there you go. So I'm very much enjoying this. And my phone is running much quicker than it had before I restored it. And I'm attributing that to the restoration, of course, not to the jailbreaking. But even with all the monkeying around I've done, it hasn't really slowed down.
So basically what you're saying is you hacked your iPhone so that it has the dream version of iPhone OS 4.0.
Yeah. It's fantastic. Having you don't know how great it is to have background processes with the ability to just kind of switch back and forth between applications that are staying open until you actually use it and see what it can do. It's wonderful.
Yeah, you know, there are times where I would like to have, let's say, like my Twitter client app running, and jump to another application, check something, and then jump back to Tweety and finish my tweet.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, apps like Tweety allow you to, if you are mid-tweet, it'll save it. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, there are times where it'd be nice to jump back or jump between applications really quick. So, yeah, I'm curious how much I would really use the background processing if it was there for all apps, because I found that the times where I'm lamenting not having it are few and far between. Now, that said, if I had it, I might suddenly decide, holy crap, how did I get by without this?
Yeah, and it's an optional thing. You know, not everything runs in the background. It's very selective as to what you allow to run in the background. And with the Pro Switcher thing, it's very obvious what you have running in the background.
You know, I'm assuming Apple watches the jailbreak community very closely for those ideas that work really well, so they can figure out how to implement them in upcoming versions of the iPhone OS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're asking in the chat room about whether voice control is affected. I am not having any issues with voice control. I'm also not having any issues with applications running. Initially, I thought, because I get some beta applications from developers, that I was getting an error about something, and it turned out that the profile had expired and it had nothing to do with my jailbreak. And I'm not really having any issues with anything. There were some initial things where there were permissions issues because I was moving files from my computer back on to the iPhone using the admin user instead of the mobile user. So it was kind of setting the permissions to admin instead of mobile. So I had to be kind of aware of which permissions were given to, you know, what files. But, you know, once I had all that sorted out, then it was fine. And that was only because I decided to save some stuff onto my computer and put it back on there later on, like the SMS stuff.
Okay. So you were doing things that many jailbreakers wouldn't be doing.
Right. Yeah. And of course, there are a lot of tools available for people who do jailbreak, such as the SB settings allows you to repair the user folder permissions in case you screw that up. There's a button that just says, I guess it kind of goes through and does a chown and a chmod and fixes that all up for you.
And wraps up with an RM.
Yeah, dash R star.
Yes.
Yeah. And make sure you run that as a super user.
That's the only way to go.
Yeah. So yeah, that was my experience with jailbreaking. I think I might write a small blog post about that on iPhone LE as well, just kind of outlining what bits I used and how I did it and what my experience is. But for now I'm leaving my phone jailbroken, and it's I really like it. I'm not pirating any applications. And I think that's when people start getting issues with applications not working properly or push notifications not working properly. But for the most part, I think jailbreakers don't have any issues at this point because they've kind of worked through them. Obviously, there's going to be weird stuff happening if a jailbreak goes bad and what have you. But, you know, it works pretty well. And I'll continue reporting on this if I do have anything more to report, I guess. I haven't started customizing my phone like crazy. I don't know if you guys have seen the people who customize their iPhones heavily, but there are some really cool themes on Mac themes and other places. There's Winterboard and what have you. I haven't done that yet. I don't feel like I want to do that to my phone.
You know, back in the old days when I was jailbreaking, which would be before
the App Store,
before the App Store, I was playing with themes all the time, and there was a lot of really fun stuff. So I'm assuming there's still a lot of really cool stuff out there.
Yeah, it's gotten even better as time's gone on. So, yeah, it's been a good experience for me so far. And with that, I will let someone else talk so I can take a breath. And I'll let Adam...
That was a lot of stuff.
I'll let Adam... do you want to talk... Do you want to ask me any questions about it, or you want to move on to our iPhone picks?
No, I'm cool moving on. I mean, that's it was really great to hear, so I'm glad you covered that, because, you know, I jailbroke once a long time ago, and it was a really bad experience. So it's kind of nice to hear that you had a good experience doing it, and that, you know, it's bringing some additional functionality that you're finding useful. You know, again, I don't know. I played outside the box for a little while, and found that I just really, there weren't that many things that I needed to do. Tethering is probably the one thing that I really, really probably have times when I would use it.
Yeah. And I know like Leighton Duncan at Polar Bear Farm, he has a jailbroken phone, but it's only set up for tethering and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, and I have NetShare, but every time I use it, I have to like relearn how to set it up. And it's just such a pain that I'm just like, why can't I flip a switch and just use this connection?
Yeah.
When I did have a jailbreak, but when I had the profile hack, that was awesome. So I do miss that. And mm-hmm. The sad thing is that's something I'd happily pay for if AT&T would just offer it to me. You know?
Yeah, I think that's the case for a lot of people. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, okay, so let's move on to our iPhone picks, shall we? And Adam, you can go first. I assume you have an iPhone pick for us?
Well, I have an iPhone pick in a way.
Okay.
It's not an iPhone app, which is different. And I realize, you know, that's valid, right?
Sure.
It's iPhone related.
Yeah, that's fine.
So, and it's going to be the thing I tweeted about earlier this week, iPhone expense monitor.
Oh, yeah.
So I forget where I ran across this, and I was late to the party on finding this, but there's an application called iPhone App Expense Monitor that basically you download it to your Mac, and then you point it at the mobile applications folder in your iTunes folder. It scans through that folder, sees all of the iPhone apps that you've downloaded or purchased, and then makes a running tally of how much you spent on the App Store.
Yeah, that's
that's pretty much all it does. It will you can export it to, I think, a CSV file if you want to take that off and do something with it. So I would imagine a person like you could actually probably use it for turning in for your taxes, for your expenses, for your business.
Now,
right?
Where is that again?
That's it. It's at wetfish.de. And it's called the App Store Expense Monitor.
Yeah, and you may or may not want to run it because you suddenly realize that, you know, all those times that you said, oh, but it's only 99 cents.
Right, yeah. Now, as far as I can tell, the way they're figuring this out is they're simply looking at the applications, and I assume they're looking at metadata, trying to figure out how much the app was when you purchased it.
Oh, is it actually looking at, I didn't even go that deep into it. Is it actually looking at historical data, or is it looking at the current price? I just assumed it was looking at the current price.
I think that it's looking at the application itself. If you did this, if you had it scan your app library while you were offline, I think it would return the same information.
And it does support multiple phones.
Mm-hmm. And multiple accounts.
Nice, yeah, multiple accounts.
Yeah, I'm not sure if price is actually built into the metadata of the application. I haven't jumped that right, deep
and I think
into
it. I might
have
called it the wrong thing. I think it might be App Store Expense
Monitor. App Store Expense Monitor. And I threw a link to that in there. And how much do you want to say? How much you've ended up?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm not too bad. And I actually, it's funny, when I tweeted this out, a bunch of people started tweeting back their prices, and I'm at $187.51.
That's good.
The most expensive app I have is OmniFocus at $20, and then StarMap at $12. So not too bad. And the average seems to be, for most people, seems to be about $200. That was kind of just the unofficial, as people were tweeting back stuff to me. There was stuff a little bit lower, some people a little bit higher, but on average, it seemed right around $200 was what most people had spent.
Right.
There were exceptions, though.
Yeah, like me.
But I already disqualified you, because I'm assuming that a lot of your apps came as...
I disqualify myself,
apps.
Yeah. Now, the unfortunate thing about this app is if you did get an application, say, a buttload of apps using promo codes, like me, that's how I quantify as a buttload.
Yeah, it doesn't distinguish.
It doesn't distinguish whether or not you actually paid real money for it or not. Now, there's an application, there's a website that recently kind of launched in beta that lets you track your purchases, kind of like a Twitter thing. What's that called? Is it Blippi? Am I remembering that right?
I haven't seen that one.
I think it's called Blippi, and there's a, and they allow you to, it, it tells you when you purchase something from the App Store, for example. So they have tie-ins, with the App Store in some way in your, into your account. So I was kind of hoping for a better integration like that, but it seems like it just scans your app folder. But for anyone who's curious, I have $3,000 worth of applications. Most of them are crap.
Yeah, and the other thing is that it does have a little menu bar icon you can throw up there. So if you want to just leave it up and running, if you're the, you're the type of person that's finding your impulse buying a lot, you know, then you can tap it in the menu bar and go, oh man, I've already spent too much. And it might actually deter you
from
spending more.
Cool. App Store Expense Monitor. It's free from wetfish.de. And Jeff, would you like to go do an iPhone pick?
Well, first, did you run it?
Yeah, whoops. Yes, I did, and it was like $250.
Yeah, so you're on average. Yeah,
I'm probably
above average.
Yeah,
I'm probably below average with what I've actually spent on applications, because a lot of what I have that I use regularly, I've gotten for free. But I think I purchased OmniFocus, I purchased Jadu VNC, and I think those were my two largest real money purchases. I think Jadu was 25 and OmniFocus was 20, you said, Adam, when you bought it?
Which one?
OmniFocus?
Yeah, OmniFocus
was 20, like $19.99.
Yeah, so I've probably spent $100 or $200, something like
Superman
that.
Superman is $186 in the chat room, so yeah, $140 for Evan.
Yeah. We're seeing a bunch of these, the guys in the chat room talking, putting up their prices. So Adam, you just did yours.
Yeah, maybe
Jeff.
I shouldn't be writing them out.
Yeah. All right, Jeff, do you want to go and do your iPhone pick?
Sure. So, but before I do my iPhone pick, is there a specific category people would prefer?
I think we all like product
show.
I think we like productivity and utility applications.
Productivity and utility. Okay, hold on.
Anything that's
let me whip open my iPhone and iPod Touch and see what's there on both.
While he does that, you want me to do a second pick since I didn't do an iPhone pick?
Sure, or I could do my pick.
I'll do an iPhone pick because it's another thing I found this week that is awesome. It's going to just save my life. Have you guys heard of CardStar? Or have you seen CardStar?
Oh, CardStar rocks.
Sorry. I just found this. Did you find it this week, Jeff? Or I think it was a featured thing. I probably found it that way. But basically, no, you know how you have... It. Sorry, go ahead.
I've been using it for a while. But go ahead. You're all excited, so talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited because if you're like me, you have a wallet and it's like super thick. And you also have a keychain with all these stupid barcode dongles for like every grocery store in your area, right? Because in order to get the discount, you have to have the stupid card.
Right, yeah.
Right? And you also have the card for Best Buy and for, you know, your frequent flyer miles and I don't know what have you. What CardStar does is it's got a huge database of different merchants, all these cards, and they're separated into categories. So they have airline, car rental, convenience store, drugstore. So like, you know, if you have a CVS card or a Rite Aid card, or you have a gas card, maybe, you know, any one of these cards that has a barcode on it. So the key is that it has a barcode on it and you have to have it scanned. What you can do is you can put them all into this app and categorize them. And then when you need to scan the thing, you just pull up your grocery card on the iPhone and they scan that. And you don't have to carry around all these cards and little keychain dongles.
That's cool. I remember this application.
It's an older scanner. It doesn't work. But if it's a newer scanner, it works great.
Yeah, see that I haven't actually used it yet. I just discovered it. So I'm praying it had great reviews. So most people were saying it works in most cases, I think.
Yeah. I've been very pleased with it.
I remember at like last year's Macworld, everybody was trying to get their Macworld confirmation scanned from their iPhone screen and it didn't work for anybody. And I remember at some point the people attending the actual, you know, helping out with the scanners, they're just kind of saying, no, it's not going to work with your iPhone. No, you just have to go over to that computer. You have to type it in manually. It's not going to work. Like, you know, because 1,000 other people had come up to them. But you, for the most part, you've seen this application work, Jeff?
Yes. And I typically use it in the grocery stores, and it's been working fine. And it has a
reverse mode too, right? So if you have to like hold it down to the scanner, I think it will flop the code so it's oriented right.
Yeah, yeah. And there was one place I went to use it where the sales guy was just a total prick and refused to let me do it.
Oh, wow.
Because, yeah, well, the thing was, he was certain he knew everything about technology. And,
he probably did.
And I'm sure he did, because he had that stereotypical look of the IT guy that hasn't ever had a date,
who
still lives in his mom's basement, and needs to work on his hygiene habits. But boy, he knew. And yeah.
And he wouldn't let you even try it.
No, he said, no, that doesn't work. And, you know, finally I said, do you even know what it is I'm trying to do? And he just kind of looks at me like, oh, yeah.
How dare you? How dare you challenge my authority at the Quickie Mart?
Right.
Exactly.
And what I wanted to say was, do you know who I am?
Yeah.
But that's totally uncool, so I didn't.
And on the off chance that he didn't know who you were, that'd be kind of embarrassing.
And then I would have gone, oh.
Well, you should, and then run away.
So that's my token iPhone pick that ran way too long.
I like that.
That
I like it a lot.
Great
I just,
iPhone pick.
Can you tell that I got my keys out and I was... I have it now. I entered my Kroger card in. That's a grocery store for those people who don't know.
And actually... we have King Soopers out here, which is Kroger, just with the regional name.
Okay.
And it works great.
Yeah, awesome. I'm excited. I'm going to go to the store. It's close to my office. I'm going to go after I leave and try it out. I'm going to have to buy something.
Yeah, buy yourself a six-pack of 3-2 beer. Because you can.
Yeah, because I can, with my card on my phone. Okay, Jeff, what is your iPhone pick? What did you decide on?
Have we done speed test yet?
I feel like we have.
I don't know that we had. I just ran it because earlier you were asking about download speeds in my area.
Okay. Tell us more, Jeff.
Yeah, tell us, Jeff.
Okay, so speed test is a cool little application that checks your network performance, or your internet performance, so you can tell what your upload and download speeds actually are. And it's great because if you're having a problem with uploads or downloads, you can check and see if you're getting the bandwidth that you're expecting. And it's also nice if you're out using, say, public hotspots, and you want to know if you're going to have enough bandwidth to do whatever it is that you're planning to do, then you can use this and check real quick. It's a very handy tool, and... off the top of my head, I don't know how much it costs. It might be free.
Free.
Okay,
free.
There you go.
Free.
Is this the speed? It's speed test? No, it's not speedtest.net or anything like that?
Oh.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. The icon looks like a little blue speedometer with a silver bezel on it.
Yep. Yeah, it's the same menu you'd run on your computer on speedtest.net.
Right, same company.
Okay, yeah, so it's the speedtest.net speed test app, because there's another one called Speed Test.
Okay, no, you want the .net one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want the .net one. And one thing I like about it is that it will do location checking, and so it will pick appropriate servers for where you are at the time. So that's kind of cool, too. Now, and of course, you can set which servers you want to use, because sometimes you might want to see what type of bandwidth you're getting when you're hitting a server on the other side of the country or on another continent.
Cool. All right. So my iPhone pick is called TripDeck. And I think we should talk about travel apps leading up to Macworld because, you know, you have an iPhone and you're going to Macworld. You should, you know, use them together. So TripDeck is a really cool application that lets you just figure out what your travel plans are. So if you use, what is that cool, TripIt. If you use TripIt, which allows you to kind of keep a nice little streamlined database of your events for something, let's say you book on Expedia, and you forward that to Tripit, right? I'm new to the Tripit thing. Is that what you use, Adam?
Yeah, Tripit is awesome. So yeah, basically what's cool about Tripit is any of your confirmation emails from any source, so wherever you make your travel plans, it doesn't matter. They give you a email address that you just forward your confirmation email to. And then once their servers get it, they actually scan it, scrape the data, and then process that into your account. And then they maintain all of your itinerary data. So they'll have all your flight data, all your hotel data, the confirmation numbers, all that stuff. And then they have an iPhone app. So there's a web app, and then there's also an iPhone app, and all of that syncs over to the iPhone app. And then they throw in some nice things like, maps from the airport to where your hotel is, and weather information and other data that would be useful for your trip. And then you have it all in one place right there on your iPhone.
Cool. Yeah. So TripDeck lets you integrate with Tripit. So you just kind of say import from Tripit, you log in with your Tripit account, and ta-da, all of your Tripit itineraries are in TripDeck. And the great thing about TripDeck is that it organizes everything in a very nice, easy to understand way, in that, I have my Macworld 2010 trip here. I tap on that and it pulls down a sheet that shows me on Tuesday, February 9th, I get on a plane from Chicago to Phoenix, and it departs at 2:10 p.m. and I arrive in Phoenix, and I can call. There's a button. It shows you little cards. So for each
Michael.
Yeah.
You're flying to the wrong city.
I know.
It's a
connecting flight.
Oh, okay.
So I go from Phoenix to San Francisco at that point. But so it gives me little cards to swipe through. So it's very nice. It looks great. It tells me when I'm supposed to arrive in Phoenix in the local time. If I have any issues, there's a button that just says call, and I click that, and it says call booking site or call airline. So if I have any issues, I can do that. If I want to share information about the trip with my family, I can share the specific card, or I can share the entire trip, and that'll send out an email. I can also pull up a map, and it'll show me, the two pins. It'll show my current location, as well as, here's ORD and here's, Phoenix. And, it also gives me information like the airline, what aircraft I'm going to be on, how far it is, how long the trip's going to be, the site that I booked through. I can also add notes to it. And, I can swipe past and go to the next card and see all the information on the connecting flight, see when I need to be there. It'll also send me push notifications whenever there's a flight delay. So I can, I have a delay. So I can stay in the Starbucks little boutique here and just keep hanging out for a while. I don't have to rush or anything like that. And it also lets you plug in other stuff, such as, hotel check-ins and stuff like, shuttles from the airport, all that stuff. It's really cool. So it's called Tripit. It's $10.
No.
What's that?
You just said it's called Tripit. TripDeck.
TripDeck. That's right. Tripit is free, I think. But TripDeck.
So, Michael.
Yeah.
Have you tried Travel Assistant Pro? I'm curious how this compares to that.
I haven't yet. But I'll write that down and I'll try it.
Okay. I think it probably costs about the same.
Travel
Assistant
Pro.
This one looks nice. You said it will import your Tripit stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the one thing is, the interface on Tripit is not...
Yeah, I took a look at Tripit.
I'm all about the beautiful interface, and it's got an okay interface. It's not horrible, but it's not beautiful, and this looks really nice.
Yeah, that's when I saw the ability to import from Tripit, I checked out the Tripit app, and I said, no, and I deleted it. So TripDeck, okay. It's $10 in the App Store. And with that, I'll wrap up this monstrous show that we've put together, and say that you can get iPhone picks and show notes at iPhoneAlley.com. You can see the list of applications we picked in case you couldn't write it down if you're driving in the car or something like that. iPhoneAlley.com/podcast is that address. You can send feedback to podcast@iPhoneAlley.com. And, of course, you can find Jeff Gamet at the Mac Observer, macobserver.com, and iPodObserver.com, as well as twitter.com/jgamut. Thanks for being here, Jeff.
Oh, sure thing. And as always, it's a blast. So thank you for having me here.
Yep. And Adam Christensen is here from the MacCast at MacCast.com and twitter.com/MacCast. Thanks for being here, Adam.
Yep. Thanks again.
Yep. And next week, I think we're going to do normal time. So for those listening to the live stream, we'll probably be doing it at Sunday at, 5:30 Pacific? I think is
That's
when
right.
we usually do it. So hopefully we'll be back at that time and you can hear when we're going to do a live show by following iPhone Alley's Twitter at twitter.com/iPhone Alley. And with that, another iPhone Alley podcast is in the can.
An internet. How are we going to communicate this?
The stylus.
We don't want to carry around a mouse, right? So what are we going to do? Oh, a stylus, right? We're going to use a stylus.